Welcome to the Resilient Training Lab podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Resilient Training Lab podcast. This month we have an exciting episode to bring to you and a month filled with fun activities. So before we get to the episode, let's recap what we have going on in July. So first, for our July challenge, we're going to be doing an overhead barbell hold. We'll have two categories, one for the power bar or a standard 45-pound bar, and one with the Bella bar or a 35-pound bar. So you're going to choose your weight, you're going to press it up overhead, keeping your elbows locked, you're going to time how long you can keep it there before dropping. The only stipulation is that you have to keep your elbows locked. So that is the challenge for July. Again, this is going to be sponsored by Victus Coffee. So the winner will get some Revolution or Resilient gym swag and a free 12-ounce bag of Victus Coffee. So keep an eye out for the winners and make sure to put in your entry by tagging at Revolution Fitness Clubs or at Resilient Training Lab on Instagram, or just putting your name up if you're a member at the gym. Other events going on, we have two big powerlifting meets in the month of July. First, coming up just this weekend, July 8th and 9th, a few of the staff members and a few of the clients are going to Las Vegas to compete in USPA Nationals. So good luck to Claire, Gina, and Tina as they head over to Las Vegas and show everybody what they've got. And then more locally, we'll have our meet July 23rd at Revolution Fitness Clubs, another USPA meet. So good luck to all the competitors. And if you are not competing, we hope to see you there to support your fellow competitors and fellow athletes. And we'll also be taking donations at the door for protectors of the animals. So we have a packed month of July. And because of that, we're throwing it back to a rewind episode of the Resilient Training Lab podcast, my favorite episode to date, with Dr. Eric Lagoy, where we talk about efficacy versus effectiveness and our just general epistemological responsibility as coaches and healthcare professionals to provide the best data and the best information possible. So without further ado, let's jump into this wormhole of a topic.
Welcome to our next episode of the Resilient Training Lab podcast. I'm your host, Ryan, here with Coach Paul and also Eric. So welcome, guys.
Thank you. Glad to be back on.
Yes, Eric is one of our favorite guests. And today we're going to get to talking about how do we know what we know? So this is a pretty nuanced topic. We're going to start out with some definitions of some words that are going to come up throughout the course of the episode. Paul's got a really nice analogy that I think we'll be able to reference back to as the episode goes on so that we can start to draw some parallels between the analogy, the fitness world, and the physical therapy world. So, Paul, you want to hit us up with that ship analogy?
Yeah, so we're going to kind of be talking about how it's our duty to provide the best information possible. And Derek Miles uses this ship example that I think kind of really drives the point home. And you have this guy, and he owns a shipping company. And he has this ship that he knows is just, you know, not put together great. It's real rickety. But he, you know, buys insurance and starts selling tickets. And people have this voyage that they go across this big journey. And he sends them on the rickety ship. And the ship sinks, right? And everyone would agree that that guy's an asshole and, you know, he collects his insurance money and he didn't really care about the people that he put on the ship because he knew he would get paid either way, right? But if we have that same story, guy has the rickety ship and this time the ship actually makes it, is the guy still an asshole? He put the people's lives at danger, but they didn't actually get hurt. So what do you think there? But what if he like didn't even inspect the ship? He just took the seller's word for it. He was like, oh, the seller told him, ah, this is a fine ship. And he just took the seller's word for it and then started selling tickets for his ship. What about that situation? Is that, you know, make him a bad person? I think the big moral of the story is that we don't want to be putting our clients on rickety ships. We want to be making sure that the ships we put on our clients, because we are leading them on a journey, are safe and sound.
Yeah, so I think when we reference back to this analogy, what we're looking at is it the responsibility of the person who owns the ship to make sure that it is safe to transport these people? And if he doesn't research the safety level of this ship, does it all come back to him? And so the parallel that we see with the fitness world is the trainer has the responsibility to make sure that they are giving their clients the tools that they need to be successful. They are putting them onto a safe ship rather than a rickety ship. And I think we could also see some parallels with the physical therapy world. So Eric, in terms of a physical therapist, what would be the comparisons you would use to apply this analogy? So what would be the rickety ship in your perspective?
Yes, I suppose that would be any intervention we would provide for the patient in front of us. And I guess I think for these analogies, physical therapy and strength and conditioning parallel pretty well. It's just perhaps the stakes are a little bit higher in physical therapy because of just the role of the healthcare provider and what we're working with in terms of pain or dysfunction of some sort versus perhaps more health and wellness directed goals. So the analogy works in both settings, but basically I would say that the stakes are a little bit higher in the physical therapy realm. But the ship itself, I mean, that could be any intervention that we choose to do, whether that's patient education or and a selected exercise for a specific reason, or some other, maybe a little bit more of a passive modality like dry needling. The responsibility falls on the clinician to know what the risk and benefits are and what the effectiveness and other stuff that we're going to talk about in a little bit is regarding that and so on.
Yeah. So again, back in this ship analogy, let's say that this individual wants to have his ship inspected, but he hires, you know, the Yelp of ship inspectors, and they're just going to give him a passing rating as long as he gives them money, and they actually don't know anything else about the safety of this ship. So that would be sort of a lower quality way to justify what he knows of the safety of his ship versus spending a ton of money to have it properly analyzed by somebody who knows the ins and outs of the exact model of ships that he has, which would be a very high quality, right? To know that the ship that he's putting people on are safe. And so when it comes to trainers producing programs for their clients or a physical therapist having a plan of treatment for their patient, we really need to take a look at how we're justifying what it is we're having these people do. We need to make sure that the ship is sturdy, the ship is safe, or the program is efficacious. Is that the word that we're gonna use today?
That's how you say it too.
Good job. Good job.
We're wearing over our head with all the E's and the F's and the C's today. Yeah. All right, so we're looking at how efficacious of a justification we're using. So, Paul, you have some definitions, right?
Yeah, so when we kind of look at any research or any method that has been researched, you can kind of look at its effectiveness or its efficacy. So when you're looking at efficacy and effectiveness, these two words are often interchanged and they do actually have like slightly different meanings. And when we're looking at specifically in terms of like research and effective study, we're looking at kind of a study that is more applicable to the real world and has kind of less confounding factors and less stringent inclusion for the study, and just kind of is going to look at a more kind of real life application. Whereas an efficacy based trial is going to be more stringent and it's going to be more in like that research setting where you kind of have that random controlled trial that you're used to seeing, where they're controlling for all the other variables and they're testing against a placebo. So that's going to be the big difference there. And we'll talk about some pros and cons and talk about how that applies to everything.
Awesome. So Eric, when you're looking at new research in the physical therapy world, are you specifically looking for examples of efficacy?
It depends on where we're at in terms of that intervention or whatever we're talking about in the scenario. So just to rewind a little bit, going back to the ship analogy, the point of that analogy is, what is the responsibility of that person in terms of, you know, knowing if that ship is rickety or not? And what we do to find that out is we read research articles and talk to other people, and we formulate an opinion on what's going on. And we try to keep that grounded in some level in science, because that gives us better confidence to basically be less wrong. And so science goes through sort of a process, especially in this world of health and fitness and physical therapy, where the first question we want to ask is this thing that we're doing safe? And then the next question we might want to say is it efficacious? So does it work in a controlled setting? So that's, and then the next step after that would be more like, is it effective, to say what's normally being performed instead of that? So does it work in a more of a general sense? And then we could ask, is it effective in various populations? So can I use this intervention with different people in different scenarios? So when you say, like, when I read research and do I look for if something's has good efficacy versus effectiveness, it depends where it is on that spectrum. You know, so some stuff like exercise, for example, there's a lot of research on that already. So rather than see if something has good efficacy, I might want to know it's effective for me to use with a lot of different people that might walk through the door. We've kind of already established in some level that in a semi-controlled manner, as much as you can control exercise research, it could be effective for a couple different conditions. And then we might want to know, or it has efficacy for a couple different conditions. And then we want to know if that is now effective in the clinic. And then we want to know if that's effective with different people that might have the same condition. So it's complicated.
Right. And so when it comes to this analogy of, again, just the rickety ship and it being the responsibility of the owner of the ship to make sure that it is safe for these people to travel on, or it is the responsibility of the trainer and the physical therapist to make sure that what they're asking their client or patient to do is both appropriate, effective, and safe for the person to do, we can kind of run into a scenario where, when we're combing through the evidence, another analogy that's going to illustrate this is, let's say we have a group of people who are looking at four identical brown socks, and or they're being told left and right, you know, sock number one is going to be a lot softer than the rest, or sock number three is browner and has a better quality of a color. And they're forced to argue over which of the four socks is going to be the best one. And they do this and they come to their own conclusions about which sock is the best. And then it's revealed to them that all four socks are exactly the same. And some people, when they're presented with that scenario, are willing to accept that they were inaccurate with their information. They didn't justify the awesomeness of their sock based off of something that was factual. And there are others who will argue tooth and nail that their sock is in fact different, even when presented with evidence of the contrary. And so I think that's something that we see a lot of in both physical therapy and the fitness world, where there might start to be some new evidence or some information coming out that contradicts some beliefs that are held very close to either a clinician or a trainer's heart, and they have a very difficult time coping with that and sort of letting what they once thought to be true go and reassimilate new knowledge into their practice or their protocols.
Yeah, so that's kind of just one of our human biases, and even more so if you have four identical socks that you don't even say there's anything different. You just say, hey, pick one of these four socks, and someone picks it, they're going to defend why they picked it to you know, to their grave when you tell them that they're all the same socks. They'll try and tell you that they're not, and they'll make up a story about why they picked that sock. And so confabulation is what it's called, and it's just one of the things our human mind does. So it's something that we need to be aware of and actively trying to push against, because if we just go about our day and don't really think about it, we'll fall into this trap a lot. So we have to be kind of aware of our thinking about our thinking. So when you're faced with new information, you have to be able to question your current beliefs and look at how that new information can be integrated into your current belief process. Because at the end of the day, people are coming to us as authority figures and looking to us for answers to their questions. And as Eric said, in the physical therapy world, the stakes are a little bit higher. But in the strength and conditioning world, the stakes are still pretty high because, you know, one of the leading cause, well, the leading cause of death in America is cardiovascular disease. And exercise is one of the shown to be one of the best things you can do. Yet only about 18.6% of Americans meet the exercise guidelines. And if we aren't doing our job to the best of our abilities, we are increasing the barrier of fitness and making it less likely that people will stick around in the long run and exercise for the rest of their life.
Yeah, there's a lot of research looking at what are the most common barriers to increasing physical activity or exercise, because they are slightly different. Exercise being more structured, and physical activity can include things like knee and exercise. But regardless of what population you look at, when you look at barriers to exercise, the two biggest ones are either there's not enough time to do it, which I think all three of us hear often, or people are just too tired to get themselves to do it. So the reason why this stuff that we're talking about is important is because we want to choose things that have good efficacy and effectiveness, because that helps fight against those two barriers. I don't want to do a bunch of stuff that's going to eat up time if it's not going to get us the biggest bang for our buck. You know, we want to do things that are going to have the best return on investment, so to speak, because those are your biggest barriers. So you don't want to spend 2 hours training if you can get just as good benefits from, you know, cutting out some of the fluff and doing that same session in under an hour or something like that. You know, that's, I think, something that comes up a lot in this podcast is, you know, trying to use research to guide decision-making processes so you don't go too far down a rabbit hole of something that doesn't have good efficacy, even if it seems like it might have been effective for somebody.
Yeah, we really do try and focus on maximizing return on investment of the amount of time somebody's spending in the gym. But these are all standards that we set for ourselves. We seek out this information to try and hold ourselves accountable to provide the highest quality product that we can without any oversight. And so there are plenty of places that don't do that, or plenty of trainers who aren't forced to. There's no position stance written out from a governing body. There's no board overseeing your personal trainers. You know, a lot of these weekend certifications are, you know, the only thing you have to have to get it is money. It's not even like you're learning that much.
You don't even need a certification anymore, man. You just need a big total and a six pack.
Yeah, that's true.
Instagram, hit me in the DMs, bro.
Have a link in your bio for sure. but yeah, I mean, it's really, there's no standards. You know, it's the Wild West in the fitness industry. It's pretty crazy what people are out there preaching to their audiences of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. It's wild. It's absolutely wild.
I think a lot of people probably get information on what they're doing, like trainers, through social media, and ends up just becoming kind of like you're listening to gurus. And so you tend not to kind of question them as much as you should. And that becomes a slippery slope of, you know, just kind of listening to people that just give you confirmation bias. So it becomes an echo chamber. And you see these like areas develop where this group of people gets married to this one style of training or this one type of, you know, exercise selection. And then, you know, we'll kind of try to pull up and see if there's any validity to that. And it's just not out there. So it's like, why is this thing picking up so much momentum? There's just not any efficacy to support it, first of all, let alone determining if it's really effective. And then I think the rebuttal that we typically get back is, you guys want to fill in the blank. What happens when, you know, you say, well, where's the research to support that? Right.
You know, my technique's just too new. They too sophisticated for them to research. So
you'll always be behind if you stick with the research. Yeah, that's the gist of it. You know? And it's kind of bullshit. That's a lazy answer, because there is a lot of research. There's no governing, not as big of a governing body in strength and conditioning, but, you know, the NSCA does put out decent position statements for certain broad stuff like youth sports, or there's other position statements on like training during pregnancy. You know, these broad concepts, but they're not always like super applicable. Like, what am I going to do with the person in front of me? But there's a lot of research out there. It's just maybe the people don't know how to access it, you know, because it is hard to kind of access peer-reviewed publications, or maybe they don't, it's hard to read them too. It's a skill that you have to develop to be able to read research, you know, so, but just saying that the research isn't caught up, that's, I think that's a bit of a lazy answer, and that just gets fed in by the social media guru system that is like forever evolving.
Yeah, it almost, even worse than just the guru, it turns into like a telephone game of what the gurus say, because the trainers just feed it to each other and it gets even more and more skewed as it goes along.
Right. So it's like, if we were to build off of that rickety ship example, it's like if all these people are sending out rickety ships, you know, and nobody's like, wait a second, you know, what's going on with these ships here? It's because they make it across the journey, and all's well that ends well, doesn't mean that that was the best way to do it, right? That was the philosophical question, I think, that, you know, when you're using Derek's example there, it gets at, like, if the ship breaks down, everyone's going to say that guy's an asshole for selling tickets to get on a crappy ship. But if the ship makes it across and all's well that ends well, nobody really even knows to question if that guy's an asshole.
And when you see a rickety ship go down, they all jump from one rickety ship and, oh, that one didn't sink, so I'm going to go on that one now. And you just get a bunch of people jumping from rickety ship to rickety ship.
Exactly.
Nobody's making progress.
Well, and the thing is, 82% of them are sinking because 82% of Americans aren't exercising, so.
Yeah.
Right. That's true. Meanwhile, there's a perfectly fine ship that just, I guess, doesn't look as sexy or something. So nobody wants to get on it, right?
Yeah.
But
big resilient, we're going on the side of it.
That's true, yeah. It just needs to be rebranded.
Wasn't there a study that just came out recently that actually said research is like 14 years ahead of common practice or something around there?
I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me. You know,
like you're saying that it takes 14 years for research to go from being completed to put into practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, but we also hear, like, so what Eric was just talking about with people talking about how there's not research available. You'll also hear at the same time, you can find research to support everything. And so I think that's why we're having this conversation, is because if, you know, somebody cherry picks a couple studies that were, you know, self-selected surveys from 50 years ago promoting the effectiveness of whatever, X or Y, that shouldn't be held to the same standard. That is not evidence to the same standard as something that may be incredibly recent, like a recent meta-analysis that looks at maybe 100 studies with 50,000 different subjects.
Right.
Yeah.
Going back to the efficacy versus effectiveness thing, because that's where people get hung up when they say that the research isn't caught up, because they're doing an intervention and they feel that they've seen some effectiveness of this. They feel like they've used it with a client or a patient and it seemed to have a positive outcome. And they look, maybe they try to look for research on it and there's just, it's just not there yet. So it hasn't established some level of efficacy. Because ideally, we want both. You want efficacy because it shows that something has internal validity, it works. But then you also want to have some level of effectiveness so that you can actually utilize that in the real world, right? But if something doesn't have efficacy, you're kind of, you know, just shooting in the dark. You don't really know. You're just going to go back to that, your mind playing tricks on you, right? You're going to think you see something and it starts to get into confirmation bias and things like that. So it does, this sort of stuff does get a bit philosophical. Maybe that's where, you know, certain trainees or trainers get a little bit scared of this stuff, you know, because it does kind of get a bit philosophical in a sense.
I think two words you used there that we didn't really define that kind of help the whole conversation and help better define efficacy versus effectiveness is internal and external validity. Can you kind of just define those topics for everybody?
Yeah, I'm just going to keep defining all these words because I know that they can be a little tricky. And, you know, I went through 7 years of graduate, you know, undergrad and graduate, and then 8 years of clinical practice, and I still struggle sometimes with the definitions of all these words. So efficacy, again, is, does this thing that we're doing work in a controlled setting? So internal validity is basically asking if we can trust that whatever intervention we're doing actually caused this outcome. So efficacy and internal validity sort of go together. I'm going to just off the top of my head, if we're talking about like people foam roll to, you know, improve muscle length or something like that, right? So internal validity would be, did foam rolling actually improve muscle length or range of motion or something like that? And efficacy would be studying that in a very controlled manner. then we get into effectiveness. So does this work in the real world? And you get into external validity. So would we get similar outcomes under different circumstances? So if that had efficacy, which it doesn't, but if it did, the next step would be, well, does that work with all different patient, different people? Does that work with all different body parts? Does that work whether I do it for 2 minutes or 10 minutes? And then you start to get into the external validity of these sort of things. So it's a bit more pragmatic, like how can we actually implement this? Whereas internal validity is a bit more like explanatory. It's a cause and effect relationship. So you want to establish that cause and effect relationship before you would start to implement it. So we want both, but you want efficacy ideally before you would start getting into effectiveness.
It's also important to note, it's not like a dichotomy. There's a range where you can be in the middle ground, and it's not going to be one or the other. And there's going to be studies that kind of take a middle ground. You'll see kind of randomized controlled trials that compare against, you know, the current best practice instead of a controlled group where there's still a lot of internal validity, but they're kind of pushing towards that effective side. So there is some middle ground there. And I think it's also important that order that Eric keeps mentioning with efficacy becoming before effectiveness. I think sometimes people, you know, search out for effectiveness before something's been proven to be efficacious.
A lot of these decisions that we're making are influencing people's lives directly, but I think very commonly we fall into a trap where we overestimate the benefits of what we're asking these people to do and underestimating the harm that our actions could potentially have on these people.
Yeah. And again, going back to the barriers for physical activity and exercise, because we just established that 84% of people aren't meeting those, and that it's a risk factor for cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality. So if the biggest complaint is that somebody doesn't have enough time, and you know, you guys in particular, and myself included as a coach, we say to somebody, how much training are you going to allot per week? And they say, well, I can get in here for an hour, three times a week. So you've got 3 hours with that person to make a difference in their life. Like, what are you going to do? You know, and we want to do things that are, going back to the definitions, efficacious and effective. So it sounds kind of like semantics when we just talk about it on a podcast like this, but it is like super important to the decision-making process that we go through. When we understand, you know, bird's eye view of what we're trying to do here, you know, like how can I, if I've got 3 hours with someone and I'm doing 20 minutes of stuff that has zero efficacy as a warm up, you know, I just, every time we train, I just took 1/3 of that person's training time and just basically sort of threw it out the window because I thought it was effective. But if I, you know, studied a little bit harder and dug a little bit deeper, I would find that the efficacy, the internal validity of that intervention might have not even been there to begin with. You know, I would have been better off doing something else with that time.
What are some of the real world consequences look like for potentially doing that in a physical therapy clinic?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about this sort of stuff on the low back pain podcast when we started talking about nocebos or connecting dots that might not necessarily be connected. So if someone comes in with low back pain and I do an intervention that, if I knew the literature, has low efficacy, so doesn't seem to have a cause and effect relationship or doesn't have good internal validity with helping to reduce that pain, but I do that intervention one or two times a week for a couple of weeks and someone gets better, I'm going to look at that and say that this intervention was effective for reducing this person's pain. But that is sort of a lie because in a controlled setting, that has not been necessarily proven. I mean, it may have worked for that individual. It may have been something else that caused that individual to feel better. There's just so many variables that you can't confidently say that that's what happened. You can't find that signal in that noise. So if I had the efficacy first, I could say, well, you know, it makes sense to try this intervention out and let's go from there, you know? So that's sort of the implementations. And in the case of something like low back pain, if I were to do something with low efficacy and it helped get that person better, so then that person now thinks that that's an effective intervention. If they develop low back pain again, what's the first thing they're going to do? They're going to go back to, you know, possibly paying out of pocket or using time out of their day to receive this treatment that, you know, may not really do what we think it actually does. So that's why this stuff is pretty important.
And so if we're looking at the same thing in the gym, Paul, I don't know what your thoughts are, if you necessarily agree, but what I'm looking at when it comes to what we provide at Resilient, right? It's if somebody is not with us and they are training with a trainer and the trainer is not choosing efficacious methods of programming, this person could potentially be turned off from training with us in the future, training or lifting weights in general, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we see this we see this on all sorts of levels, right? I mean, from the simplest level of someone who's been doing something a certain way for a long time and may have been successful when they first started doing it, because, you know, everyone's successful with absolutely anything when they first start training. The newbie gains are real.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then they come to us and, you know, their wheels are spinning and they've been doing things a certain way that might not be proven or be efficacious. And then they get stuck in those ways and they kind of are, you know, hesitant to change because that's what they've always done. And then we see this on the next level where people have been coached to do, maybe we just had a technique podcast, so we'll use technique in this example, coached to do a movement a certain way. And they just keep running into the wall. They're not progressing, or they keep hurting themselves or whatever it may be. And they're doing a technique a certain way, and they've been told that that way is dangerous because of reasons that haven't been researched and haven't been shown to be efficacious. And then they're afraid to do that movement because they've been told they don't have the movement capabilities to do it, or they're doing it incorrectly. And then on the third level is someone who's been scared away from training altogether because they worked with a coach that ran them down the wrong rabbit hole and completely disinterest them in training.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that those are two, potentially three really good examples. And that ties back to the brown sock, right? These people are attached to brown sock number one. And when presented with evidence that brown sock number one is not superior, right, they have to be willing to change their mind. And so in some cases, right, like all the socks are the same, but the analogy holds true even if like the training that somebody had been following could be improved on, right? They have to be willing to sort of let go of what they had been doing to get where they are, because that's not necessarily what's going to get them to where they're looking to go.
Yeah, and coaches too. Like if I think any of us can say, if we look back on what we were doing 5 or 10 years ago, we'd laugh, because I know for sure that I was doing things that now I would be ashamed of. So it's kind of our duty to try and be, you know, less wrong each day, because, you know, I'm hoping in 10 years I look back at what I'm doing now and laugh at that, because we are continuing to advance our knowledge and continuing to question our beliefs and question what we're doing. And when we're introduced with new information, being able to put that into our current principles and adjust accordingly, and having kind of like virtue in our pursuit for knowledge and just not just adopting knowledge without checking it out first yourself.
Yeah, I think you have to sort of, and we sort of embrace that aspect to this, because it's not that science has all the answers, because science does not have all the answers and it's constantly evolving and it's open to its own biases for sure. But I think if you sort of try to be less wrong constantly, you will find that you have more confidence in what you're doing. And to what you're saying, Paul, you sort of naturally evolve with science instead of like always trying to stay ahead of it, you know. And that starts to get into like doing things just because they're trendy or because they're kind of like the new thing or the shiny, you know, going after the shiny new object sort of stuff, right? So, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, what works is usually boring, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I know, I hear that too. And, you know, it's just like always like you got to know the basics. Now we sound like old coaches, I think. So we're like telling all the other coaches and therapists and stuff to just get really good at the basics, but people don't respect the basics enough. And that doesn't mean that it has to be boring. I mean, you guys, you know, make things fun, right? I mean, nobody that I know, any client Resilient, has been like, yeah, you know, I've had great results, but it's just so boring. I can't do it anymore. It becomes fun in all the other aspects because we are humans. So it's not like we're just, you know, doing an input and an output, which is kind of probably what it sounds like with this conversation. But you do the stuff that has good efficacy, even if it's boring, and then you make it fun and engaging in other ways, you know?
Well, like making progress, I think.
Yeah, progress is definitely one way, but...
It doesn't get likes on the gram, though. How are you going to get all the likes and follows?
I guess I don't care about that.
We need props and stuff that no one's ever seen before to get the likes.
You just need to get 6 screenshots of your leg veins while you're squatting 605 or whatever it was.
That's right.
Well, I think Ryan brought up the real thing there is progress. That's really going to be what makes people buy in the long run. And that's something that we've kind of talked about in the past.
You can make progress with things that don't have efficacy, though. It's like you said, the newbie gains, right? So somebody can go to a trainer and do a bunch of stuff that, you know, to us might look kind of silly, or we might at least think there's a little bit of a better way, but they get results out of it. And so that feeds back into that loop of like, this must be great. And then you present to them with the facts that actually this actually isn't the best way to do this. And it goes back to the brown sock thing, right? So, you know, progress for, I think, more advanced trainers, you know, which we definitely have trainees that are more advanced, when they see progress, they really get, you know, we really know it's because of whatever system we've put in place. But when it comes to some of the newbie stuff, you know, you can get progress whether you're doing things with good efficacy / effectiveness or not sometimes, you know. So, again, knowing the literature gives us more confidence that these aren't just newbie gains, but they're going to continue to see progress beyond that, right?
Yeah, and oftentimes I hear arguments from other trainers saying, like, hey, if it works, it works. Progress is progress. Like, can't argue with progress. And then you may bring up the conversation of, well, there might be a better way to do it. And then they get into, oh, how do you know there's a better way to do it? And this is how we do the research.
If it works, it works is like the anti like science. That's the rickety ship guy, right? He got across. So if it worked, it worked, you know. Yeah, well, you're kind of an asshole though, dude. You know, so, and I don't know, I guess it's what you put into it though. You know, we're passionate about this stuff, and you know, we use our free time to do these sort of things, so I guess that's part of it too.
And to continue on what you were saying about making progress, I think that's a really good point. That I think the easiest example of is like a 14-year-old, right? They're going to get stronger no matter what they do, just because that's
the speed camps. That's a perfect example, right? You see all the speed camps and like every 14-15-year-old is like, you know, burning through ladder drills and getting faster and buffer, but they're just hormonal teenagers that are responding to, you know, they're primed to respond to any input, right? And then they go to like their D1 college, and the coaches, you know, coaches there are just gonna just hopefully probably just gut that and have to start over with the basics, you know. So,
and I think that's where we can kind of highlight what we do as being different, where it's like, how many people can you help, or for how long can you help them, right? It's like, how many people can make progress in their first few months in the gym? I've seen clients doing a lot of things that I didn't agree with who made a lot of progress those first few months, but at what point does that trainer then lose the ability to help them? So again, referencing back to the rickety ship, it's like, you can be on a rickety ship and not know it and get across the Atlantic a few times, but eventually, you know, the statistics aren't in your favor. And so the more you can stick to both the efficacious and the effectiveness, right? So it's like, if we can focus on that stuff, we're just able to help people more consistently over longer periods of time. You know, how many other places could a guy like Carlos go for programming and be able to make progress? Like, it's pretty
small. That's what you just touched on, Ryan. That's a good question I'd like to ask you guys, because if someone comes into me for physical therapy, and a lot of this happens a lot, they're requesting an intervention that might not have great efficacy. Maybe they know somebody that found it to be effective, or maybe they've had it in the past. For whatever reason, they want to do something that I might not typically do. I kind of have to either educate around that and see if I can maybe get a change in their belief structure on what else we might want to do, or I have to give a little bit. I'll do a little bit of that, and let's do a little bit of this stuff that I find to be useful. So I kind of dance around that stuff all the time. But if you guys get, and I know this happens, you get new clients in and they want to, you know, they want to spend 30 minutes foam rolling or doing all this other sort of stuff that you might not normally program in because you don't think that the efficacy and effectiveness is there, you know, what those conversations look like. Because that's the humanistic part of this whole thing.
Yeah, it's a very similar situation where you need to educate them, but you can't just, you know, tell them they're wrong off the bat and like just throw it in their face and be like, oh, the research says this, you're wrong, because then they'll just leave.
Yeah.
So you do have to give in and give in a little bit and kind of let them do the things they believe they need to do, and then add in the things that you know they need to do, and slowly start to wean them off those things that might not be effective or efficacious, and start to kind of educate them slowly and do it by example, where, you know, we maybe in the foam rolling example, they let them, hey, come in early, do your foam rolling before the session starts on your own time, and then let's implement this new warm up and see how you feel. And they feel pretty good. Maybe we get them to foam roll 5 minutes less and they're like, oh man, I still feel good. And eventually they're not foam rolling at all, and their warm-up's down to just 5 minutes so they can spend the next 55 minutes working out. But you do have to, you know, give a little at the beginning. And like we've talked about this whole episode, is it really comes back to lowering the barrier of fitness and keeping adherence high. So if the person doesn't enjoy what they're doing, they're not going to adhere to it. So there's got to be some enjoyment there. So meeting the client in the middle and over time educating them on, you know, these topics, you know, this podcast will probably serve that purpose in some cases.
One of the things that you do at Resilient that I like is having some of the more senior members serve almost as a mentor to the newer members, because there's a certain amount of social learning that occurs with that, right? So if someone comes in and they want to do 30 minutes of foam rolling, and then they realize that, you know, nobody else, you know, any of the other members, or especially the senior members, are necessarily doing that, and they're surviving, they're doing just fine, you know, and they're making progress, they're going to learn from that. And we don't get as much of those interactions in the clinic due to like HIPAA reasons and stuff, but our clinic is pretty open. So, you know, we do have somebody that this happens fairly often, where somebody, you know, in their 30s is fearful of lifting something from the floor because things can make their back worse. But there's a 50, 60 year old, 70 year old next to them picking up 30, 40, 50 pounds, you know, piece of cake. So there's a little bit of social learning that occurs there, and that really helps reframe beliefs. So I love the mentorship idea there, because I think that can get over some of like the stuff that might not have the efficacy or the effectiveness, but it's not coming from you guys too. They're learning that through the experience.
There's a lot of really strong people that work out with us, and there's a lot of people, when a new client comes in, there's almost always someone that has kind of done what they're after. They have like similar goals and have completed them and have gone through that journey, and they can kind of see what they're doing and how they're training and how it's worked for them. And they're much more likely to buy in when everyone else is around them is, you know, kind of training hard and hitting the big movements and spending their time, you know, pushing adaptation instead of laying on the full floor, rolling in circles.
I think they also get to see what is in their future. If they stay consistent and they work hard, they can see how strong the people around them are and know that it's going to be accessible to them as long as, again, they put the effort in.
And that's it for part one of our effectiveness versus efficacy podcast. This is a topic that we feel so strongly about that we ended up rambling on for about 2 hours and had to break it up into two parts. So be sure to join us next week as we continue this discussion. Hello, and welcome to part two of the Efficacy versus Effectiveness podcast. If you missed part one last week, we suggest going back and listening to that, where we introduce the topics of efficacy and effectiveness, the differences in between them, and we also introduced an analogy that we refer back to throughout the show about a rickety ship. And in this week's episode, we continue that conversation and continue to talk about why it is important to have science backing what you do and why it's our duty as coaches to be sure that we're putting out the best information possible. We really enjoyed recording this one, so we hope you enjoy listening to it too.
are our goals as trainers and as physical therapists when it comes to touching the lives of our clients or our patients?
Yeah, I think that's something important to remember with all of this is like why we got involved in this. And I think when you ask almost any personal trainer or physical therapist, they got involved to help people. And I think sometimes that gets lost in this, I don't know, maybe trap of trying to make money or trying to create something new or trying to maybe gain recognition or become one of those gurus or whatever. Sometimes we get kind of pushed off that main goal of helping people and we start to get sidetracked. So I think it's super important to remember that we got this into this to help people. And in order to do that to the best of our ability, we need to make sure that we're constantly looking to get a little bit better each day so that we can serve the clients we have to the best of our abilities.
Yeah, I remember a very early realization I had when I was, you know, out of school and in my first full-time job as a personal trainer, realizing that these people were in front of me with very real consequences if they didn't take action, whether that was not being able to participate in activities that were really important to them or literally having their long-term health threatened if they didn't make some pretty hefty changes to their lifestyles. I remember thinking that if I'm going to be partially responsible for their successes, I need to make sure that I'm doing everything that I can or I'm as on top of all of the different tools that I could potentially have in my toolbox. Because if I missed one that could have helped somebody and they suffered a consequence as a result of that, then I wouldn't feel that I was doing my job to the best of my ability.
Coaches definitely have a large, probably larger impact on their clients than they realize. And as a therapist, I learned that because of my, you know, my background in strength and conditioning and training, you know, majority of my life, I've always dipped into both worlds, you know? So when I actually became a physical therapist, it was natural for me to network with a lot of coaches. And then coaches started referring clients to me because they basically thought I would probably be a better physical therapist for their clients than if they just went to any old physical therapist. And it really started to amaze me, like how many clients would listen to their coaches over, say, their medical doctors. Their doctors would say, I want you to go to, you know, the clinic downstairs. And their coach would say, you should go see Eric. And most of the time they would take the coach's advice and go see me, you know. And when I started seeing that, I really realized how much clients look up to their coaches and really respect their opinions. So, you know, going back to what we're talking about, responsibility, it does fall on us as coaches or therapists to make sure that we are being the best we can be. And that starts with trying to be less wrong and trying to be a little bit better every day. So yeah, that's just been my experience, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think coaches realize, especially new coaches, realize how much of an impact and influence they have on their client's life. Because if you really look at it big picture wise, these people spend more time with you as their coach than probably almost anyone in their life besides their partner and maybe some of their family and the people they work with. So you're in like a very small group and the people they work with, they, you know, may or may not actually want to be there. So
that's true.
At least, you know, they're coming to you and spending like all their free time with you. Like people don't have a lot of free time and they're choosing to spend it with you. And you become much more than just a coach in that aspect where, you know, people look to you for all sorts of advice and look to you as a role model. And if you're not, you know, again, doing your best to try and be a little bit better every day, you're going to let down a lot of people.
I think that a lot of trainers do take those steps to be a little bit better every day, but they end up falling into the trap of subscribing to one school of thought or one method. And so, again, our rickety ship analogy, this is probably the guy who hires somebody and doesn't necessarily take all the precautions to make sure that the ship is safe, right? Is that what you guys would say?
Yeah, I mean, it's much more easy to ride the wave of three-letter acronym than to really question what they're doing and how it fits into your philosophies and your principles.
I think that people you know, I would give them the benefit of the doubt and say that a trainer that is seeking out a three-letter acronym likely has the best of intentions, however misled they may be. Do you guys disagree?
No, I agree with that. We talked about before how a lot of people, particularly trainers, will say the research always falls behind, you know, what we want to do. And I believe that they believe that, right? I think that they mean, what they mean by that is, you know, there's this new thing that definitely works. It just hasn't been proven that it works yet, but I'm going to use it because I know it works. And then the intentions are there, you know? So I do believe that most people have well intentions, even if I don't disagree with, even if I disagree with what they might be doing.
Overall, I think people in the field have good intentions, and sometimes does come back to maybe not, you know, questioning themselves and being in a position to change their beliefs.
So does having good intentions negate the negative outcomes that they're creating? And I'll offer myself up first. I don't think so. I think even if you have fantastic intentions, if you're creating negative outcomes, no matter your intention, I don't think that that's acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to, like, you know, is ignorance acceptable? And, you know, given the fact that you have put yourself out there as a coach and you've put yourself out there to help other people, automatically makes you responsible for what information you're putting out.
Yeah, no one's gonna really always know, because I said that in physical therapy the stakes are a little bit higher, but they're still relatively low. This isn't life or death stuff we're talking about here, right? It's health and fitness and you know, exercising and physical activity. But and that's maybe that's why there's not a strong governing body, because I'm sure, like, an anesthesiologist, they can't just be like, well, this isn't shown in the research, but, like, I'm pretty sure it works. I know this guy that, like, teaches it, and, you know, he seems really smart, so I'm going to start, you know, giving this person this type of medication when they're under anesthesia. Like, that would never work, right? Because that person could die, you know? So yeah, I'm kind of with you there, Ryan. I don't think it's acceptable, but how do you fact check that, you know? Because especially with the lack of the governing body, I mean, when we talk about three-letter acronyms, most of them are just, they're just marketing things, right? Very few of those acronyms you earn. Like, I have a physical therapy degree, so I went to school and I graduated with my DPT, and then I got a license. Those ones matter, you know, because that's what allows me to be a physical therapist. But there's so many other letters that you can throw after the name, and you can, you know, you can just pay a bunch of money and throw those letters there. It doesn't necessarily mean anything, because there's not anybody fact-checking, and I think part of that's because the stakes are only so high.
Well, and I think a lot of that comes back to our schooling and education and kind of being taught from, you know, this abnormal perspective and always trying to find what's wrong with the person in front of us and kind of fix them, and not learning how to, like, train the whole person in front of us and kind of broaden our view and finding ways to connect with that person. And we learn about whatever internal and external rotation and how much hip internal and external rotation we need to do X exercise. But, like, people aren't their internal and external rotation. It's much more multifactorial and much more nuanced than that.
Well, what you're talking about, I'm going to butcher this word as well, is epistemologic responsibility. So
epistemological.
Epistemological. So what, I feel like I'm wanting to read all over and over again. So, I mean, what we're really talking about is, you know, the active pursuit of information to either prove or disprove what your current beliefs or protocols are when you're dealing with your clients or your patients. And everything that we're doing is going to have an effect on another person's life. So we can't dial that search down to zero. We always have to be looking for new evidence to guide us in what we're doing.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I've done a decent amount of teaching, as you guys know. And I can tell you that position, standing in front of a room of students, and you can say whatever you want, and they're going to write it down and take that word as, they're going to take it as correct. You know, so even in that sense, I almost it's almost like you're that the guru for the day when you're presenting in front of a group of people that are, you know, there to listen to you. So one of the things I wish I learned more in school, I guess how to think, for lack of a better word, because that's really what all this boils down to, right? It's not just taking somebody's word as gospel, taking things at face value, but really trying to be able to scrutinize it.
I think we really are sounding like those old guys, right? Because when you're a student, you just want the teacher that tells you what to do. You don't want the guy who
Exactly.
Yourself,
right? Exactly. Right. I think we're just getting old. We're just like bitching the whole time. Is that what this podcast is? And another thing.
That's what most of them turn into. So I think there's another part of this is kind of learning. Another thing that I kind of wished I learned in school was learning more about how we learn and how the human brain works and how we kind of problem solve. Because a study I saw that was super interesting was they gave these people a set of lights. They had to hit a certain sequence of lights to win a prize. And, you know, people are just hitting random sequences. But as soon as they find one and they get the prize, they just keep doing the same one over and over again. But what the researchers didn't tell them that there was 20 solutions to the problem. And they found one solution and they just kept doing the same solution over and over again. But there might have been a more effective or more efficient or more time-saving solution that they just never even explored because they found one that worked and they just kept doing the same one over and over again. And that's our bias. That's how our mind works. Our mind is inherently lazy. And once we find that solution, we're not going to search for a new solution unless we are actively trying to and actively, you know, questioning our beliefs and questioning if there are more solutions to the problem.
Completely turned my mind inwards. Now I'm just thinking about what I'm doing. And I'm like, shit. Turning on the light the same way. I've never heard that analogy before.
That one hurts your brain.
Yeah. I immediately also thought of clients who have experienced successes in the past and they immediately revert back to whatever they were doing when they were losing weight. The most common example I can think of is somebody telling me that they lost a lot of weight when they were in school or whatever, and they would go to the gym for 2 hours a day, 6 days a week. And I'm like, well, can you do that now? Do you have the time to go to the gym like that frequently? And the answer was always no. Now they're married. Now they have kids and a career. And it's like, okay, well, like just because that turned the light on when you were in college, like it's not going to be a successful solution now. So we have to look for other ones.
Yeah. So that pursuit needs to be intentional. It needs to be voluntary. There needs to be a willingness to self-examine and admit that you're wrong. You need to be aware of where you're getting your knowledge and the credibility of those sources and looking for firsthand sources instead of secondhand sources. And then surrounding yourself with like-minded people. And when I say that, I don't mean people that agree with everything you say. I mean people that are also on that endless pursuit of bettering themselves and endless pursuit of knowledge, and preferably ones that disagree with you so that you can have those tough conversations and start to find those common themes in what you all think works. And usually those common themes are the things that have been proven as efficacious and effective.
But yeah, I think that's a great point that we want to surround ourselves with people that will challenge us, but also care about the same things that we do and are also looking to, you know, relentlessly better themselves in similar areas.
Yeah. I think Greg Lehman has a good analogy here. He talks about finding the active ingredient and looking at all these different things that people are doing and finding what's similar in all of the different interventions. And those are usually those things that you need to be focusing on.
That's what I always try to look at when I see somebody that get good results from something with little research to support it. It's like, well, what, you know, I understand their rationale for why it might have worked, but what other reasons why might have worked that they're not looking at? You know, is it that they're, you know, spending this time, this extra time with their client, and they're really like selling it and they're hands-on with them and they're, you know, just like driving that home? Or is it just something else? But there's a lot of reasons why something could work besides the light switch thing, I guess, right? There's a lot of reasons why something could work besides the obvious one that people are assuming, especially with exercise. That's what makes exercise research so difficult, because when we talk about validity, we want to look at one singular thing and see if that one singular thing caused this outcome. But you really can't do that when you're having humans exercise, because there's always physiological and non-physiological factors that tie into the results. So you can't compare yoga to strength training and just say, well, strength training has more load than yoga does, so that's why strength training has these results. That's part of it, but there's so many other factors that tie into it that you can't just isolate out one singular thing when you look at exercise research, and that's what makes it so complicated. So one study will come out that supports this, but when a whole shitload of study comes out and then that systematic review comes out and kind of contradicts that one study, that it's frustrating to say, well, I thought it worked, but it doesn't work as good as I thought it did, or it doesn't work any better than any other thing that we would have done. I like that light switch idea, because that really resonates with a lot of, what I see when I think people misinterpret research or just kind of get their own confirmation bias for why, their whatever works where somebody else's might not.
Yeah, that can lead to some difficult conversations with clients too, where it's like, hey, we've been doing X and I think we might want to pivot to Y, and there are some reasons for that, and I'll share them with you if you want, but I think it shows growth as a professional if you're willing to leave something that you thought was maybe more effective or efficacious than it was, and really just being able to be like, hey, I was wrong.
Well, and I think, a big part of why this conversation is so important is the exercise science field is very young. I mean, science as a whole is relatively young in the grand scheme of things. And at the beginning, they were concentrated on studying things that were more life and death. And, they've just recently gotten around to studying exercise and pain and those types of topics. So we're looking at, a really young field and that's constantly changing. And we have to admit that we're wrong on a pretty regular basis. And, I think that some of people's hold up in science is like, oh, they're always saying different things. And it's like, yeah, because, in the grand scheme of things, we don't know everything and we're constantly learning new things. And science does have the tendency to prove things wrong more than it does have the tendency to prove things right or prove things that work. And it's like being able to look at science as a whole and support science as a whole and not just, nitpick studies or maybe not use studies at all.
We're supposed to assume we're wrong until proven right, not the other way around, right? And that's what a lot of this stuff turns into.
So, yeah, looking at science as a whole and not just nitpicking studies, I think some of the other complaints that we hear are that studies don't happen in the real world. We kind of brushed on that, the fringes of that, this whole conversation. And another one is, that's not my population. I train elite athletes or I'm an elite athlete, and that guy in that study only squatted 400 pounds and I squat 600 pounds. So that study doesn't apply to me. So what do you guys think about those complaints?
I think that we've talked about something similar on previous episodes. I don't remember the exact example, but just wherever you are on that performance spectrum, that the principles that make you perform better don't change as you increase your strength or whatever trait you're looking to improve. So there's the nuance of your program changes. So regardless of how strong you are, your physiology is the same as it was.
The principles are still there, right?
Yeah. And your human physiology doesn't change if you squat 200 pounds or 600 pounds. You're still, the physiology is still the same.
Plus, it's hard to do research with a bunch of 600 plus pound squatters. There's just not that many of them. So if you kind of use that as an excuse, you're going to always be just kind of guessing more or less on, so you're never going to have a system that's going to help you kind of see that signal and the noise of your training. Like what are you responding to? So even if you kind of want to be a little bit more skeptical because the population in that study doesn't sound like you, that gets into effectiveness though, right? Is this generalizable to you? And it might be more than you think, because if we're talking about a particular study on something like squatting for improving strength, there is efficacy already established for that, right? We already know in a controlled setting that's a good way to get somebody to have somebody improve their squat, let's have them squat. There's good efficacy for that. And then there is some effectiveness there to say that just because we don't have a ton of studies with 600 plus pound squatters, we're pretty sure we can generalize it to that population because the physiology is still the same and there's just been enough literature in that area. So let's use that as our building blocks for your program instead of just saying, well, that research doesn't apply to me. I'm just going to do whatever instead.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are some studies out there on super high trained individuals, and we do see similar responses. It's just the magnitude of change that's different. Like, you know, someone new to training might get a huge, huge gains out of a certain intervention, whereas someone who is very advanced might get less gains, but they're still both getting gains from that intervention because, again, that physiology is the same. So oftentimes it's just that magnitude of response that differs. And then we also see that people talk about age groups like, oh, you know, this, all the studies are done on college kids that are looking to make extra money. But, you know, the studies that are done on middle-aged people and the few studies that are done on women, again, tend to show similar responses with just different magnitudes. So when we're looking at efficacy-based studies and starting there, and then that usually gives us a good groundwork, and those studies are more likely to prove, or those interventions are more likely to prove effective than ones that don't have any efficacy to begin with. When I'm designing a program and someone runs into a problem, say, let's use an example, let's say their bench press is stalling. I'm going to go to the research and look what has the most evidence, and that's going to be what my toolbox is made of. So I might see, you know, something about manipulating volume or manipulating frequency and that having good effects. So that's might be where I start over, say, doing BOSU ball dumbbell bench, one-arm dumbbell bench presses, because there's no research there. So yeah, maybe we can find, you know, people say that, oh, you can find a study to find anything. And yeah, maybe you can find a study to back you up, and there's might be one or two, but I want to find where there's the largest group of evidence and start there, because what science does is it finds what works most or works the best most of the time for the average person, right? So if we just assume that everyone that comes to us is average and work backwards from there, then we're going to waste way less time than doing it the other way around.
Yeah, one of the things that we do, and I think this is because we are so scientifically driven, I guess, is collect a lot of data on clients too. So we also can pull from, we have that building block off of the efficacy and effectiveness and knowing the literature. And then as we work with someone for months on months, we collect all this data on them. So when their bench press stalls, we're, first of all, we're confident that we've been doing a solid program grounded in these principles, but then we can also look back on the previous data points and see what did that individual specifically seem to respond to best? And that could be slightly different than somebody else. And, you know, that's where you start to get maybe a little bit away from being too scientific, you know, because what worked for somebody might be a little bit different for somebody else, but it's still grounded in those principles.
Well, and I think that brings up another super important part that I think a lot of people miss when it comes to research is they'll see maybe something that has been shown to work over and over again, and they'll try it and it won't work for them. And they'll be like, oh, science doesn't work. This didn't work for me. But we got to remember that when we're looking at the conclusions of an experiment, those are, again, the averages. There's always going to be some inter-individual response to that intervention. And no matter how effective or efficacious intervention is, there's going to be a group of people that don't respond or maybe even respond negatively. There's going to be a group of people that respond well, and there's going to be a group of people that respond like astronomically. And knowing that, and knowing we might have to try different interventions to find what works for the person in front of us, again, comes back to that whole idea of coaching the person and not just looking at, you know, their internal rotation or external rotation and making them their hip, looking at them as a person.
Right. And nothing is as simple as, you know, black and white, yes and no. It's a spectrum. And so if somebody implements a protocol that they looked at the research for and it didn't happen to work out for them, rather than just dismiss it entirely, think if there are any possible reasons that, you know, it didn't work for you at that moment in time. Because I think as soon as we write something off, our likelihood of revisiting it in the future, it decreases significantly. But if you can come up with reasons why you think it might not have worked in that moment, rather than dismiss it completely, it might be a useful tool that can come back around when the circumstances are right.
Or even vice versa, why something worked that wasn't supposed to work, right? And I think people like things to be black and white. They like things to be yes or no. They want a specific answer. They want do this and do X and Y will happen. And it's just, it's not like that. That's not how training works. That's not how life works. Everything's on a spectrum. Everything has gray areas. And as every strength coach's favorite answer, it depends.
Yeah. I think of just this one kid I knew who loves running 5-3-1. He just tries anything else and doesn't make progress. He's like, I'm going to go back to 5-3-1. It's like, rather than think about why, like, what is he doing within 5-3-1 that's making it work? At some point, I think we did touch on this earlier too, like the buy-in matters. If somebody is thrilled and hell-bent on one mode or method and you can't convince them otherwise, like they're going to be successful with it because they're bought in and they're going to work hard.
That's the first question I ask when I comes down, because, you know, we're talking about all this science stuff, but when I talk to a client about a program, the first question I ask is, did you even like it? You know, let's start there. I know I got all this science stuff going on that we're talking about that, you know, got me to the program that I gave you, but did you like that?
Yeah, at the end of the day, our beliefs and expectations are going to shape our reality. I say it all the time. And that's part of the reason what makes all of this so muddy is that, you know, there's always beliefs and expectations and social learning and confirmation bias and all these factors going on, even in a controlled experiment. So, you know, there's noise no matter what. And our goal is to try and eliminate as much noise as possible and figure out what really works.
So we've been talking about the differences between efficacy and effectiveness. And ideally, in a certain scenario, we would have both, right? But there are sort of pros and cons to each one, right, Eric?
Yep.
So when you're looking at, can you give me like a specific example in the clinic where you might prefer one to the other?
Well, it's not so much a dichotomy of one or the other, but, you know, you ideally would have a little bit of both, but it goes back to the validity thing. So the efficacy being more cause and effect. So if I want to do something to reduce pain, it would be nice to know that this intervention does that. You know, you just kind of found that signal and all the noise there. And so we need well-controlled studies to prove that there is efficacy there. But a lot of people might come in with similar complaints and they're, you know, different ages, different genders, different everything, right? And so now we start to get into, will this be effective for anybody that presents with this? Can I use this intervention with anybody that presents with similar situation? So it's always sort of a going between the two of them. You know, if I see a study that showed that a certain exercise was effective for shoulder pain in, you know, women over the age of 60 that have stiff shoulders, can I use that exercise with women in their 40s that just have painful shoulders that isn't stiff? Or can I use that in a 20-year-old male swimmer? You know, that's where you start to get into more generalizable applications. So we're kind of constantly always doing that, because just so many different walks of life come through the clinic and there's only, you know, so many really strong, efficacious types of interventions.
So I think that's a good point, is that, you know, that's not a dichotomy. It's, you know, they simply ask different questions. Is efficacy-based trial is going to be best or going to be good to study a new intervention and see if it has the specific effect we think it has? And then, you know, effectiveness trials are going to be able to better capture, you know, the multifactorial nature of training and programming and inform us how treatments or interventions compare to the currently available interventions or standards of care. And I think it's important that, you know, they're both there and there's those checks and balances.
So if there, like, hypothetically was a practice that you might be considering, you might find it to be effective, but it hasn't been proven yet, so its efficacy is in question. Is that something that you might prescribe to your clients, or is that like a no-no in the physical therapy world? Does that ever happen?
It certainly happens a lot. And that starts to get into, which we touched on before, things that are trendy or possibly fads in physical therapy or even in strength and conditioning. So typically that probably comes up on the patient's end. So if they request something specifically, you know, there has to be a little bit of give and take there. And those are case by case situations. But I kind of use this sort of 90-10 rule that I hear a lot about in nutrition, right? So if you follow a diet 100% of the time, you know, you're going to get probably good results. If you follow that diet 90% of the time, you're also going to probably get similar results than if you had 100% compliance. So you don't need to be 100% perfect. So when I create training programs or when I'm working with someone in a physical therapy setting and we have a certain amount of time allotted to do stuff, I sort of think of that 90-10 rule that I hear a lot about in nutrition, where as long as, you know, the majority of what I'm doing is grounded in things that do have a bit of efficacy and effectiveness, if the other 10% improves my relationship with the patient or client or improves the buy-in or adherence or compliance on the patient or client side, you know, then maybe that we give a little bit there, at least initially, because we don't want to lose that individual as a client or as a patient, you know. Now, if they want that to be 90% of their treatment and I'm only going to get 10% to do the stuff that I think might be more helpful, then that might not be a good fit. Just in terms of, you know, I might not be the best therapist for that person. I've kind of reached a point in my career where sometimes I'm okay with that, I think, you know. So does that kind of get into what you're asking, I think?
Yeah, and I think that's actually the second time you guys have kind of brought up that concept. The first time was when we were talking about a potential client in the gym who is used to doing something a certain way, and we're starting to show them new ways of doing things that might be more efficient. And my thought was just that, you know, if people are coming to us, chances are their level of fitness probably isn't going to be phenomenal. So if we can give them that, again, that 90-10 example, you know, 10% of the stuff they do, we know we could probably make it more efficient, but it's going to keep them bought in and they're going to really start to trust us a little bit more if it's there, rather than right out of the gate, you know, we beat them over the head with, no, that's not in the research, so you can't do it. I think they're going to be a lot more successful.
I also think it comes back to weighing the risks and benefits and doing an honest evaluation of what you're having your client do. And the 90-10 rule works perfectly. And here is, you know, if you're spending 90% of the time doing things with high benefit and low risk, you're probably going to be doing good. But you do still want to make sure that if you're doing things that may not have the science behind them, that there isn't a lot of risk involved. Like, so we may try some, I don't know, respiratory drills that don't have any science behind them because there's really no risk to doing them if the person's willing to. But we probably won't ever have someone squat on a BOSU ball because the risk there is huge. So even if someone came to us and said, hey, I want to, you know, squat on a BOSU ball, I'd ask them, are you in the circus? And if they told me no, I probably would have a conversation with them why that's not a great idea.
That actually circles back pretty nicely to the order of things that I think I touched on in the beginning, where, you know, the first thing we're supposed to ask is it safe? And the next thing would be, is there efficacy behind it? And then, is it more effective than, you know, what might be typically done? And then, is this possibly effective in various populations? So if somebody comes back in to you guys or to myself and they're requesting something that you might not normally do, you just loop back to that first thing. Is it safe? No, and then you're going to stop there, right? Squatting on a BOSU ball, you know, the risk rewards is not there. And then you go, is there efficacy behind this? So let's say like some respiratory type drills, not really, no. So then you go, well, 90% of what we're doing is what I want to see, you know, the 10% that they want to do, we'll probably still get really good outcomes. And, you know, I'm just establishing some rapport with this person. So I think I'll concede that we can tie this in as a filler exercise with something else that I want to do. because it is safe. And then, you know, maybe over time they'll say, yeah, I don't think I really need that. I'd rather, you know, I'm going to give you the reins completely now. So I want you to do 100% and that 10% goes away. Or maybe they just really like it. And that's just something that, you know, because everything else is going according to plan, you just kind of concede on that one. And that's how we kind of think grow as coaches and clinicians.
Yeah. Cause I mean, that client clinician relationship or client coach relationship is super important. And there is research that shows, you know, the stronger that relationship is, the better results that person's going to see. So again, that circles back to looking at science as a whole and being able to apply it to what you're doing in a sense that is practical.
Yeah. And to sort of tie a nice bow on top of this, everything that we talked about was centered on looking at the research and determining whether it's applicable to our clients or our patients. So at the end of the day, we can make sure that we're not putting people on rickety ships and they're not going to be at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, no rickety ships, guys and girls. Make sure we're checking our ships and hiring inspectors and doing everything in our power to make sure the ship gets to the other side.
A lot of structural integrity in our yachts. Evan Rudes on the back. Thanks a bunch for listening, guys. Eric, thanks for your time. Thanks for joining us, giving us your insight as to how a physical therapy professional looks at the research. And yeah, you know, like we said, there's probably slightly higher stakes there, so you have probably combing through research pretty frequently. As always, if you enjoyed us stumbling over our words and laughing at us, leave us a 5-star review. All of us on Instagram are _ resilient and our first name. So Ryan_resilient, Eric_resilient, Paul_resilient, and resilienttraininglab.com.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Thanks for listening. Can't wait till next time. And thank you for joining us on another episode of the Resilient Training Lab podcast. Hopefully now you have a better appreciation for the nuances of research and the widespread effects of the words you use and the narratives you create. Hopefully we will see you at one of our July events. If you want to catch the nationals, it will be live streaming. If you check out USPA's Instagram, they'll have the link there. I'll also post it in my profile, Paul@PaulResilient, so you can check it out there. And then July 23rd, we hope to see you all at Revolution Fitness Clubs for the local USPA meet. Have a great month, and we will catch you next month.